Video Catskill.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, hospitals across Pennsylvania and New York are under new pressure after a controversial move by the White House. President Trump issued executive orders that eliminate federal funding for hospitals providing gender-affirming care to transgender youth, while also declaring that the federal government will only recognize two genders, male and female, but not everyone is backing down. Kimberly Izar reports on how the Eastern Pennsylvania Trans Equity Project is doubling down on its mission to support transgender individuals. New York ended the prison strike with an overtime deal, but fired thousands of corrections officers, creating a staffing crisis. We'll find out how the state plans to fill the shortage. And in a world of so many opinions, it's difficult to trust ourselves, but that's exactly what the voices behind the podcast You Can Trust Yourself are here to do. That and more after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Trump administration says it's freezing more than $2 billion in grants to Harvard University. This comes after Harvard refused to comply with a list of administration demands. Some of these demands ranged from cutting DEI programs to eliminating student groups. Harvard says no government should dictate what private universities teach. Harvard Law professor Andrew Crespo says cutting federal funds to Harvard will also hurt all Americans.
The impacts of those cuts will be severe. Not just to cutting-edge research, cures for cancer, cures for diseases, studies that try to understand the most cutting-edge technology, but also all of the work that happens at these universities with respect to how we study our history, the things that are essential to our democracy.
He spoke to CNN. A whistleblower has disclosed to Congress his concerns about alleged actions by the government cost-cutting entity DOGE within his agency. NPR's Jenna McLaughlin reports DOGE's handling of sensitive data appears to be a widespread concern.
The National Labor Relations Board is a small, independent federal agency that investigates and adjudicates complaints of unfair labor practices. Daniel Baroulis works for the NLRB's IT department. In a disclosure to Congress and other federal overseers, he says DOGE appears to have gotten access, right before a big chunk of sensitive data was removed from the agency and records were deleted.
Why was that done? And that's a purposeful effort. That doesn't just happen. Logs don't just disappear.
While the NLRB tells NPR they have no record of DOGE's access and that an internal investigation concluded there was no security breach, Barula says the suspicious activity he noticed warrants further investigation. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
A private group says the number of abortions in the U.S. increased slightly in 2024 from the prior year. The Guttmacher Institute studies reproductive health and supports abortion rights. It says its survey shows there were more than 1 million abortions last year. The Institute says one reason for the increase is likely the availability of abortion medication. Stocks opened higher on this tax filing deadline day. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 180 points in early trading.
At last count, more than 100 million people had already filed their tax returns, and the IRS had processed nearly all of those. Slightly over half the people filing so far used a professional tax preparer, while the rest did it themselves. More than 2 out of 3 filers received a tax refund. Bloomberg reports that China's government has ordered airlines in that country not to accept any more jets from Boeing. That's the latest move in the U.S.-China trade war. Boeing stock fell. Bank of America shares opened higher as the bank reported better-than-expected profits for the most recent quarter. CEO Brian Moynihan says bank forecasters are not projecting a U.S. recession this year, although he acknowledged what he called a changing economy in the future. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. A Pennsylvania man is being held without bail in connection with the weekend arson attack on the Pennsylvania governor's mansion. Cody Ballmer faces charges of attempted homicide and terrorism. Authorities say he told them he had been harboring hatred toward Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. The authorities say Ballmer told them he would have beaten Shapiro with a hammer if he had reached him. The recipients of the prestigious Guggenheim Fellowship have been announced this morning in New York City. As NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, fellowships are going to nearly 200 scholars, scientists, and artists across 4 dozen fields.
This is the 100th class of Guggenheim Fellows. They range from a paleontologist studying evolutionary responses to climate change to the best-selling novelist Miranda July. She talked to WHYY's Fresh Air last year about writing All Fours, a book hailed as perhaps the first great perimenopause novel.
Like, if you're hiding the place where you're actually at, then it's hard to get to the next place.
Other Guggenheim fellows include the novelist Jonathan Lethem and artist Theaster Gates, known for making abandoned old houses and buildings his medium. On average, grants range from $40,000 to $55,000. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
The WNBA held its draft last night. UConn star Paige Beckers was the top pick. She will go to the WNBA's Dallas Wings. Again, on Wall Street, stocks are higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 170 points. The NASDAQ is up nearly 100 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. New York Presbyterian and the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center are part of the growing number of hospitals in New York and Pennsylvania that have stopped providing gender-affirming care to patients under 19 years old. This follows President Donald Trump's executive orders to cancel federal funding for hospitals that provide gender-affirming care for trans youth and mandating that the federal government will only recognize two genders, male and female. But these actions haven't stopped the work of the Eastern PA Trans Equity Project, a nonprofit empowering transgender people in Pennsylvania through a legal name change clinic, financial assistance, peer-led support groups, and several other mentorship and advocacy programs. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Iser spoke to Corinne Goodwin, board member of the Eastern PA Trans Equity Project, about what these executive orders mean for trans people in Pennsylvania.
I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about the legal name change clinic. I know you talked a little bit about it, but can you give me a sense as to how many people you have served through the clinic, and if you have seen with this new administration an increase, or has it been relatively on par with what you've seen in previous years?
Yeah, so our name change program last year, we served over 640 people. And that can include things as simple as providing mentoring and answering questions on how to do the process, to providing all of the court documents that people need to complete their legal name change in Pennsylvania. It's usually about 40 pieces of paper that you have to file with a court, including the instructions, as well as providing financial assistance to people. Last year, we provided about $40,000 in direct financial aid for people seeking legal name changes.
Wow. And the 640 people that you have served in last year, do you have a sense as to how many folks you've served so far in 2025?
My head, I'm going to say we're at about 250 right now.
Wow. Just in the first quarter of the year.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And is that an increase from what you've seen in, I guess, Q1 of 2024?
Yeah, so that would be an increase over Q1. What we saw is that, frankly, after the election in November, we saw a huge spike in the number of people requesting assistance with name changes. You know, so we went from an average of, maybe three or four people a week that we were providing, financial aid to as many as 15. As an example, and lots more phone calls and people seeking questions on top of that. And that pace has largely continued through the first quarter of this year. So we serve 42 counties across the state, and some of them are more highly populated than others, right? So Montgomery County, Lancaster County, Lehigh County, they have a higher population, obviously, than Wayne or Pike. But we absolutely see people on a regular basis coming from Wayne and Pike County.
I'm wondering if you could, Corinne, talk a little bit more about the challenges that you've seen, particularly in the more recent months with the name change clinic. President Trump, he released that executive order that they're only going to recognize two sexes and passports. How does that impact your work?
The first thing I'll say is executive orders are not law. And many aspects of that executive order and subsequent executive orders are being challenged in court and, are in many cases being stayed by the court pending that litigation coming to a close. part of the order that you're referencing is that for the purposes of the federal government, right? So this does not mean private companies. It doesn't mean that it's a law in local counties and Wayne and Pike or anything like that. But for the purposes of the federal government, they're only going to recognize two genders, male or female. And so, for example, where somebody could get an X gender marker on their passport or on their social security account, so X being for non-binary, they have removed that option for transgender people, for non-binary people to have that option. So essentially, like if there was a form, for example, for Medicare, Medicaid, where you're going to, you know, apply for Medicare, Medicaid, or, you know, some sort of an intake thing, and there may have been, you know, a gender designation on that form of male, female, or non-binary, they're removing the non-binary option. So, for example, if you're applying for a passport, you will no longer have that non-binary designation available to you. You will only be able to choose male or female. Many years ago, I had a passport that had a male gender marker on it. After I got my legal name change completed, I applied for a new passport with my new name and a female gender marker on it. If my passport were to expire in the next 3 years, 4 years, and I was to reapply for a new passport, they would revert my gender marker back to male.
I see. And what are you hearing from folks about how they're feeling in this moment?
Yeah. So, and let me just, I want to follow up on my last comment. So,
yeah, of course, please.
For the purposes of, so for legal identification, if somebody gets a legal name change, you know, you change your name from John to Janet in court with a court order, you can get your chosen name, your new legal name, set up on all forms of legal identification. That includes passport, social security, state ID, state driver's license, real ID, as well as birth certificate in Pennsylvania. You cannot get your gender marker changed any longer on federal ID. So that is social security and passport. You can, though, still on your Pennsylvania birth certificate, your Pennsylvania driver's license, your Pennsylvania non-driver's license or state ID and a real ID, you can still get not only your name updated, but also your gender marker updated.
I think that there is a lot of misinformation floating around. I really appreciate that distinction and kind of walking us through it.
And it's important to note that, so number one, the forms of ID that you're going to be using more times than not are driver's license or state ID or real ID, right? Very rarely do you have to present a passport unless you're traveling overseas. What we are seeing, though, to your point, is lots and lots of confusion and lots of fear, right? So people are afraid that to travel overseas or to go on a cruise, they have to present their passport. Are they going to be allowed back in the country? And the answer is that if you have a valid U.S. passport, whether it has an M, an F, or an X gender marker, you can leave the country and you can come back in the country. You are a U.S. citizen. And assuming there isn't some other thing going on, absolutely you can get all, travel without an issue. And in fact, transgender people have traveled the world for decades and decades and decades and decades with passports that don't have their chosen gender marker on them.
Right.
It was really only about 20 years ago that you could get your gender marker changed on those documents.
Yeah, that's a very
But people
point.
Are afraid, right?
Of course.
They're concerned about their safety. They are concerned about their ability to just navigate in society, right? So if we get outside of the issue of legal ID, the executive order has told, the departments in the US government that, for example, I, as a person who is assigned male at birth, cannot use a ladies' restroom in any federal facility. Social Security office, in a federal courthouse, at a national park, at the U.S. Capitol. And it's important to note that transgender people, according to the Williams Institute at UCLA, are four times more likely to be physically assaulted than any other marginalized community in this country. So, you know, when I go into a public restroom, I tend to, you know, dash in, do my business, and dash right back out because, frankly, I'm afraid of being assaulted, right? And I am more likely to be assaulted as a transgender woman in a men's room than I am in a ladies' room.
I want to also touch on some of the advocacy work that the project is doing. I know you mentioned that UPMC is stopping to offer gender-affirming care for, I believe, new and some of their existing patients. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that and who will be most impacted by these, you know, the stopping in care?
So these hospitals and provider networks, they are running scared of the federal government, right? Because the threat from the Trump administration is that they will withhold reimbursement from Medicare, Medicaid to these health networks if they provide affirming care to people under the age of 20, so 19 and below. The result of this is going to be that young transgender people who are already at higher risk for depression, suicidality, and other mental health issues will be feeling that pressure even more. And frankly, these healthcare networks and the Trump administration will have blood on their hands.
Is there anything, Corinne, that we haven't touched on that you want to lift up about why this work is so incredibly important and really life-saving for many people that we haven't already talked about?
Well, I think that it's just really most important to talk about the fact that fewer than 30% of people in this country say they have even met, much less really know, a transgender person. And, you know, you tend to be afraid of things that you don't know. So part of our mission around building community is to build community by building alliances and being public and talking about transgender people and, you know, what our needs are, what our requirements are. Most transgender people live very mundane lives, just like the rest of Americans, right? They go to work, you know, they go to school, they want to get a good education so they can get a good job, so they can make a bunch of money, so they can buy a bunch of stuff, right? That's kind of the American way. The things they are worried about, you know, which is, you know, are they able to put food on their table? Are they able to keep their car in good repair? Are they able to pay their rent and their mortgage? You know, those are the same things that everybody worries about. Most of us lead very, like I said, mundane lives, just kind of going about our business, just like most people in this country.
Yeah.
So get to know us and the fear will go away.
It's Kimberly Izar reporting. We'll take a break, and when we come back, it's been almost 2 months since corrections officers began a three-week-long strike that halted operations in prisons across New York. But key questions remain for the New York prison system. That's next. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Mimi Bradley, Radio Catskills Development Manager, reminding you that a great way to keep public radio here in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania is by becoming a Sound Supporter. Sound supporters give small amounts, $20, $30, $50 a month or more, that add up to a big help. Plus, Sound supporters get special thank yous, like drawings for tickets to events in our community throughout the year. Become a Sound supporter. Go to wjffradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we hear from a tax and budget analyst who's been sounding the alarm for decades.
My nonpartisan approach is to be critical of everybody in Washington.
She says that just about everything we think about U.S. tax policy and the national debt is at least half wrong.
Oh my gosh, we're in deep trouble.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new releases, film festivals, nostalgic screenings, live music events, and more. Information and schedule at thecalicoontheater.com.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. After a corrections officer strike halted prison operations across New York, the state made a deal to improve working conditions by raising overtime pay and capping hours. But in the wake of an intense staffing shortage, thousands of officers were fired. Junyoung Han from the New York Public News Network has been following this story. And from the Albany Bureau, she sat down with Jimmy Vielkind to talk about the aftermath of the strike, including how New York plans to fill a staffing shortage of 4,000 officers.
So, Junyoung, the state has taken different approaches to this.
Yeah.
Facilities have started an aggressive recruitment strategy,
mm-hmm.
and Governor Hochul has considered lowering the age requirement for corrections officers. Is any of this working?
That's right. The idea would be to lower the age requirement from 21 years old, which is how it's set right now, to 18 years old. And so I asked one assembly member about this. Her name is Mikhail Solage. She's the leader of the Black, Puerto Rican, Hispanic, and Asian caucus in the legislature. She thinks it's a really good idea because she believes that the next generation can help reshape the prison's culture system. But she also says that the state is going to have to find some way to recruit people from racially diverse backgrounds if they are serious about changing the culture of its prisons.
And we should note that this needs to happen now.
Yes, because when the strike first began, Governor Kathy Hochul sent in National Guard troops to help ease and alleviate the staffing shortages. To keep those troops in place, it has cost the state $100 million a month. So in addition to trying to recruit more corrections officers, the state is trying to also figure out how to reduce the footprint of the system entirely. So
and theoretically, the need for fewer officers.
Right. So the state is considering closing up to 5 prisons.
And what are lawmakers saying about this proposal?
Well, Republicans are rejecting this idea because they think that the better idea is to just rehire those fired corrections officers.
Yeah. So Republicans, of course, don't have power in the state legislature. And they've also embraced one of the demands of the striking corrections officers, which was to repeal the HALT Act. Now, mm-hmm. that law limits the use of solitary confinement in prison facilities. But the Democrats who control the legislature have said they're very unlikely to change or repeal that. So
right.
where are we going from here?
Right now, the state is looking into how the law is being implemented. But what I've been surprised by is over the last few weeks, I've heard a growing number of corrections officers and their family members say that they actually don't want to repeal the law outright, which is a departure from their original demand, but rather want to have some changes to how it is functioning at the day-to-day level. That is being assessed right now in real time by the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision.
So last question. In the middle of the strike, incarcerated people were left without access to medical care, programming, and at times they were just on lockdown. And mm-hmm. the strike came right as a half dozen corrections officers were indicted for murder in connection with the beating death of prisoner Robert Brooks. So did the strike halt progress that some of the reformers in the legislature who were pushing to gain more rights for incarcerated people before the conversation shifted?
If you were to ask criminal justice advocates and progressive lawmakers, they will say yes, that this strike was entirely a distraction for justice being served to Robert Brooks, and that this strike was a distraction of the growing number of assaults on inmates committed by staff over the last few years. In the wake of Robert Brooks' death, Hochul did vow to put in more body cameras and stationary cameras in prisons. She also put together an external review group to assess the culture of the state's prison system entirely. But because of the strike, I'm told by the governor's office that that external review group's work was affected, and the office did not elaborate more on what exactly they meant by that. But we should be seeing a report from this group later this year, hopefully providing some sort of recommendations for how the prison system can move forward.
Well, great. We'll certainly be looking for that. Junyoung, thanks for breaking this all down.
Thank you, Jimmy.
And more from the New York Public News Network. Lawmakers are returning to the state capitol today, hoping to get closer to passing a $252 billion state budget. It's already more than 2 weeks late. Most of the stumbling blocks involve Governor Kathy Hochul's recommended policy items rather than financial differences. Syracuse area Senator Rachel May says legislators need more time to consider what are sometimes controversial measures.
It's her one chance to put legislation on the table. And the legislature, it's our job to really think through legislation. That's what we're there for. And so there, this is always where the impasses happen.
Some of the governor's proposals include changes to discovery laws, which cover how evidence is shared before a criminal trial. Another matter is the so-called mask ban, which May says has generated hundreds of angry emails from people worried about the health and cultural implications. She says it seems the governor is less willing to compromise this year than in the past.
It's been frustrating for us because we've really talked through all of the ins and outs and what we can give on and what we can't give on. And you hope to have a two-way willingness to do that, and I haven't seen it yet.
For now, Governor Hochul appears to have the upper hand. Lawmakers don't get paid until they agree on a budget. May says when she and her colleagues return to Albany, she expects they'll pass another budget extender until Thursday. We'll take a break and be back with more Radio Chatskill after this.
Hey there, it's Jason Dole. I just want to thank the hundreds of listeners who donated during Radio Catskill's spring fun drive. Your support keeps local news, culture, and conversations alive and well throughout our community. And if you didn't donate, you still can, anytime at wjffradio.org. Remember, whatever happens next, we will be here for you as long as you are here for us. Do your part and donate at WJFFradio.org. Thank you.
On the next Radio Lab, the story of a piece of plastic we don't think about very often.
The cassette changed everything.
The cassette tape.
Cassette tapes were absolutely central in the Iranian Revolution.
The impact on China was just utterly profound.
I mean, you can draw a clear line from the cassette to the internet.
No.
Absolutely.
Join us for the first episode in our four-part series, Mixtape.
Wednesday at 1 on Radio Catskill.
This is Ira Glass. On This American Life, we bring you deeply reported stories about some of the most important issues facing our country. But that's not all.
Guess what? I'm waiting for my bus.
For instance, a five-year-old who gets to ride the school bus for the very first time.
Oh, man.
That's my bus! It's really
hot! Personal stories of the biggest and smallest kinds every week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In a world filled with noise, opinions, and pressure, learning to trust yourself can feel like a radical act. That's exactly what Meg and Maggie are here to help us do. They're the voices behind the podcast You Can Trust Yourself, a weekly show where vulnerability meets wisdom and where personal stories become powerful tools for growth. Megan Spencer is a clinical mental health counselor in training. She specializes in working with women through a person-centered approach. And Maggie is Maggie Fitzpatrick, who you may know. She's a coach specializing in optimizing mental and physical human performance. And we have them both here. Maggie is here in the studio. And we have Megan on the phone. Megan, you there?
I'm here.
Okay, great. Thank you both. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Welcome back. We previewed this with you, Maggie, a few weeks ago. You've had a podcast for a while with Megan. Tell us a little bit about the success of this and what inspired You Can Trust Yourself. How did this all begin for you guys?
Yeah, interestingly enough, it actually began as the Meg and Maggie podcast. So Meg approached me and said, Maggie, I really want to start a podcast and I think I want to do it with you. And I said, okay, let's do it. And we didn't know what to call it. We weren't quite sure what we were going to talk about. So we just started with our names. And that was back in 2021, I think. And it then evolved into Becoming Intuitive, where we were really having conversations around how we can learn how to trust ourselves. That was really the foundation of the conversations that we were having. And over 100 episodes later, we now just got a little bit more specific with the name, hopefully able to find more people who really want to learn how to block out all the noise that's going on around us and really learn to tap into our own intuition and be able to trust ourselves.
Yeah, I want to ask you both about your individual backgrounds. Meg in mental health counseling, Maggie in performance coaching, and we know that from some of your appearances here previously for your Moving Toward Health column that's now ended, but you're still here to share your wisdom in a broader sense. But with Meg, how do you think that your background complements Maggie's in this podcast?
Yeah, so Maggie and I have always had the common thread of it, just a common interest personally of how the heck do we make decisions that suit us and lead to, you know, developing this confidence and self-trust to be with ourselves. And from a professional lens, like a clinical lens, that's exactly how I show up for my clients in sessions. A lot of people think that therapy is all like the therapist gives you advice and, you know, all those things. And there's certainly moments of that. But I really focus on with my clients, like, you have a lot of this knowledge inside of you. Let's explore that and let's go deeper and find that. So it's something that I really, really feel connected to personally and also professionally.
Maggie, I'll ask you the same. How do you think they complement each other?
Yeah, I think that we complement each other really well because we're able to see two different sides of the same type of situation, right? So, for example, one thing we were talking about on this last week's episode that we were actually talking about on the phone this morning is this concept of like adding up little wins, right? And we've talked about this before with moving toward health. And when I'm thinking about that, I'm thinking about like the actual physical act of doing the thing, whether it's exercise or anything else we're trying to improve. The more we can stack up little wins, the more chance of success we're going to have, right? And I'm thinking of that from, you know, a very tactical, practical lens where she's going to come at it from a more mental health focused perspective. And you really get a whole picture of each concept that we're discussing on all of the different episodes. And I think that that is really beautiful because no matter what you're looking for, you're going to get it when you listen to the episode.
And I want to ask you about this latest episode, but I also just talk about this whole idea of self-trust and how the podcast is centered around that. Why do you guys think that's such a crucial topic in today's world, especially for women?
I think it's really... go ahead, Meg.
I was just going to jump in and say that I think it's something that a lot of times we kind of take for granted, our ability to trust ourselves, because it's so easy. I mean, even think about it from like a really bird's eye view of being able to Google everything or get the answer from, you know, my new best friend of ChatGPT, of being able, you can find answers to almost anything. And the art of being able to really listen to yourself will never go out of style. And it's something that we have to continue to nurture. And I like that you mentioned, especially as women, because it's just something that will always be necessary and something that we have to maintain.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think that it's easy to get wrapped up into listening to everyone else's opinions. You know, it's easy to be faced with a crossroads or a situation. It might not even be a problem, right? You just have to make a decision. And it's easy to initially turn to someone else and say, well, what do you think? And just listen to what they think. But what they think is based around their point of view, their perspective, their lived experience. It not, doesn't necessarily translate to us, right? And what we need in that moment. So the ability to take advice from others and, you know, be able to listen to it and maybe consider, how does that really impact me? How does that really apply to what I need in this moment? And be able to make decisions for ourselves is something that with practice is one of the greatest tools that we can have.
And in the latest episode of You Can Trust Yourself, you tackle something so many people struggle with, making exercise a consistent, positive part of life. I know we've talked about this here, but in this episode, it's part two. You have a two-part series, and I'm going to just try to get up a little clip here to give folks an example of what you guys are talking about.
Concept daily. Mm-hmm. I see a video on TikTok. I read something in a book. I see it on a billboard. I'm like, oh shit, that's really, I like that. That's stimulating, right? It's stimulating my mind. And we don't really take the little nuggets unless we're able to sustain them. So let's talk about this. First thing I want to kind of open us up with is I had to really switch my mindset very slowly and very practice-like ways of going from this perfectionistic style approach to approaching exercise to just more of a consistent and sustainable way of doing exercise. That has been probably the biggest game changer for me is I would show up to a class that was really, really hard, right? And I would do it and I would push myself and I would feel dead and exhausted and I would leave and be like, I hated that. I hated it. But I'm like, oh, well, I already signed up and I already paid this money for the month, so I better go a few more times, right? I better keep going. And then same thing. I'd go, I'd show up, I'd push myself to the breaking point, I'd push myself to the limits, and again, I'd walk out and be like, oh my gosh, that was really hard. Like, how am I going to do that again?
So I think a lot of us can really identify with that. Why did you choose to focus on this topic for this two part of your podcast?
One of the reasons that we were so excited to do this episode in particular is that exercise can be such a beautiful way to practice self-trust, because we only think about exercise from like, oh yeah, I gotta be healthy, I gotta, you know, maintain, help my bones feel good and all the things. And all of that is valid and beautiful. And it's the perfect opportunity to practice self-trust of every time you enter into a gym, a class, a walk, a yoga pose, whatever it may be. There's this ability to be with yourself in those moments and to give yourself little challenges, or to give yourself grace of saying, today's not my day that I'm going to, you know, push myself to the breaking point. And what you just heard in that clip of me sharing that was so many years of doing that and being like, why isn't this working? Why can't I sustain this? And I think it's because self-trust was missing. And now when I approach exercise, there's so many days where I'm given maybe 45% in the gym. And then the next day, maybe it's 97 or whatever it is. And that is more a sustainable way for me to stay consistent. And so we share all about that. There's a beautiful opportunity to practice self-trust with exercise.
And, we talk about this topic of like gym anxiety or class anxiety. I was thinking about this morning. Like, I really need to get back into yoga. But I thought to myself, I don't really want to go to a class where people know me. Like, I don't want them to judge me. I'm sure the people that are in the class that I don't know would still judge me. But I just have that there's an anxiety I've built up around it. So what are some practical ways do you think someone can work through these anxieties that they create for themselves asking for a friend?
Yeah, for all the friends out there, I think that we could dive into what to do to get yourself there, right? Yeah. But I want to talk about for a second, let's say, okay, you got yourself there, you worked up the courage to make it into the room. Now what, right? Well, the act of showing up, the act of putting ourselves in that room and doing it is all the practice that we need in order to start to build evidence that we can do it, right? Sometimes the yoga class, imagine like a hot yoga class, it's going to be so hard, you're going to sweat so much, right? That class and its intensity might be really hard, and that might be a challenge. But sometimes just showing up and putting yourself in the room is all the challenge that you need to overcome in that moment. And if you do that and you put yourself in that room, you overcome whatever the challenge is for the day. Now you've built up evidence that you can do it. Mm-hmm. And now you've built up evidence that, oh, this is something that I am capable of, right? We talk about feeling capable a lot in this episode, because when we avoid those things that are hard, that make us feel scared, now we're avoiding our capabilities. And when we face them head on and we show up and we put ourselves in the room, now we've built up a little bit more of that capability. We've shown ourselves that we can do it. And that is really, really important, because that's going to carry over into the rest of our life.
You guys also talk about the impact of childhood experience in this episode and how that can shape our adult relationship with fitness. Can you share a little bit more about that and how it might show up in your own journeys, Megan?
Yeah, absolutely. So anything, you know, a lot of times I really subscribe to the belief that we're nurtured in a certain way or not nurtured in certain ways. And exercise can be a big way that we kind of see that. Maggie and I talk about this in the episode a lot, that Maggie, you know, her upbringing, she was more naturally like athletically inclined and just free sport athlete, really just capable in that physical sense. And I was not. And I would show up to the sports, and oftentimes I got cut from the teams. And it was something that, you know, as a kid really like hit me in some ways of feeling like, oh no, well, maybe I'm just not good at this. And then I'm just not going to try. And when we become adults, it's so easy to do the same thing. It's so, so easy to get caught up in that same kind of narrative of, oh, well, I'm just not good at it, so I just don't want to do it. Because that can feel like we're collecting evidence that we're just not good enough, when in reality, we just have to find our places that we can start to build the evidence, just like Maggie said, of, okay, I'm not a kid anymore. I may not be going and trying out for an adult soccer league, and I can finish this walk. I can bump up this treadmill by 0.2. I can do this yoga pose for 10 seconds longer than I thought I could. And it can almost rewrite and rewire that experience of, just because I may not have been good at this doesn't mean that exercise isn't a necessary and beautiful part of my life.
I may have discovered a childhood experience that's blocking my yoga practice. You also talk about how, well, this is related to how community actually can be a big motivator for fitness. And you know, finding that supportive circle. What kind of advice do you have for folks trying to find that supportive circle, or just understanding how community can be a good motivator?
Keep trying. I think the biggest thing that we do is we have one bad experience and we give up, right? And we talk about this a lot in this episode, because if we want to put ourselves in situations that make us better, right, that make us learn that we can do it, and like I said, feel capable and learn how to trust ourselves, then we can't give up the first time that something doesn't go our way, right? That's actually really counterproductive to the goal. And so we need to give ourselves the opportunity to try something. And if we don't like it, it's okay. That doesn't need to mean anything about us, right? I could go to CrossFit, for example, and not love it and say, that wasn't really for me. And I have to make a choice there. Does that mean that I'm bad? Or does that mean that CrossFit's just not for me? Right. And we have to make the choice that says that environment I went into isn't exactly the one for me. Now I have to go find a new one. Now maybe I go to a yoga class. Right. And I go there and I say, wow, I really like this, but I didn't really feel like anyone, you know, I didn't feel like I made any friends. Okay. Well, now does that mean that I'm bad? Or maybe I just need to talk to someone next time I go to a yoga class. Right. And see if these are the type of people that I want to be friends with. And when we do that, and we give ourselves the opportunity to keep trying, then we give ourselves the opportunity to build that self-trust. And like I said, it carries over into the rest of our life, because now you're going to be able to do that same thing in the workplace or at a restaurant or anywhere where you want to feel more community. And community is really powerful, because when you start doing things with a group of people, there's this like built-in form of accountability, right? Where you show up to the same group all the time. If you don't show up, they're going to be like, hey, where were you? Are you good? Right? And it gives us a little bit of that extra motivation to help us keep going.
We mentioned how the podcast is about the broader lens of trusting yourself through health and wellness. We're talking about fitness in these two episodes that you've just most recently done. Where could listeners start if they wanted to dive into this podcast? And do you have a particular episode that you both think best represents your mission? Megan?
It's hard because so many of them, every single episode is going to have self-trust built into it. So first of all, to get started, we are available anywhere that you can find podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. We have a YouTube channel. Come find us on social media, especially. Instagram is a great place to start because we have everything linked there for you at You Can Trust Yourself Podcast. But all of our episodes are going to have self-trust seeped into them. So for example, I specialize more in mental health, Maggie more in the physical health world. And every single episode, though, is going to have that undertone of building self-trust. So for example, an episode, you know, recently before we dove into the physical part was actually specializing in anxiety, panic attacks more particularly. And that's an area that I, as a training clinician, really specialize in. And there is so much practice with self-trust when it comes to anxiety or anything that we could be experiencing. So I don't have one off the top of my head that comes to mind, Maggie, you might, but every single one is going to really leave you with that encouragement and tools of how do we begin to trust ourselves in this really, really noisy world.
I think the one that most people, it has had the most listens recently, so that's a good sign. If you scroll back just a couple episodes in the feed, you're going to find one with the Self-Trust Starter Pack. And that one gives our three most favorite and simple things that you can start implementing to really start on your journey of building self-trust. And I think that if you're looking for one that, okay, yeah, I'll listen to this latest episode, but not really interested, I think that that one is a great place to start.
Yeah. And I was looking through, just scrolling through, and I saw one recently last month, which caught my eye, which is Religion and Politics, Trusting Ourselves to Go Deep with People Who Believe Different Things. So just seeing this breadth of things that you're covering is also encouraging for folks to see that there are a lot of different areas. If you're not into the exercise part, there's different places where you guys are helping folks trust themselves. Okay, before we go, I'm going to ask you the hard-hitting Barbara Walters question. How has hosting this podcast changed the way you trust yourself? Ooh, Megan?
I think for me, being able to have these conversations with Maggie and to build this community, our community name is the Trustees, being able to just build this place of being able to show up through different conversations and techniques has been a really, really beautiful place to land. And a lot of our community has said they feel the same way. And that just feels really, really special to have.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And I think for me, being able to learn how to articulate things that are maybe hard to explain, right? Like you brought up that religion and politics episode. These are really hard conversations to have, right? And in that episode, we're not talking about our religious beliefs or our political beliefs. We're talking about how do we have conversations with people who maybe don't agree? How do we hold ourselves in that moment, right? And that's just one example of a part of life that's really challenging, right? And we find ourselves in that situation often. So I think for me, being able to learn how to talk about that and be able to do it in a way that other people can resonate with, like Megan was saying, our trustees, you know, being able to have conversations that bring everyone together in a way that makes us all feel really included has been one of the biggest growings of self-trust for me.
That's Megan Spencer, a clinical mental health counselor in training. She specializes in working with women through a person-centered approach. And Maggie Fitzpatrick, a coach specializing in optimizing mental and physical human performance. They're the voices behind the podcast, You Can Trust Yourself. It's a weekly show where vulnerability meets wisdom and where personal stories become powerful tools for growth. You can hear it wherever you get your podcast, and I'll talk to Maggie, and we'll get it up on our website, too, under the podcast tab at wjffradio.org. Thank you both for being here and for helping us learn how to trust ourselves a little more.
Thank you so much. This is great.
Thank you.
All right. We'll take a break, and we'll be back with more about the Catskill Repair Cafe. If you have something that needs to be fixed and it's broken, you can give that beloved item a second chance and keep it out of the landfill. That's next. This is Radio Catskill.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, you'll hear the Liberace of the accordion, Les Baxter's African Jazz, and Stereo Overstimulation by Juan Esquivel. Daryl Brogdon here. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
This is Ari Shapiro with NPR. If you've been thinking about helping this station with a contribution, but now is not the right time for a financial gift, you can donate a vehicle you don't need. Pickup is free, and it could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Think about it, and thanks.
We accept any vehicle, running or not, including cars, trucks, boats, RVs, motorcycles, and more. Donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we look at what it means to claim the identity of Latino and Latina in 2025. Should Latino be a racial category, or is Latinidad a fiction? And how do we answer these questions when simply existing as a Latino today can make you a target? That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, got a wobbly chair, a toaster on the fritz, or a favorite pair of pants with a tear? Don't toss them. Fix them. The Catskill Repair Cafe is back for its second community event Saturday at the Catskill Firehouse on Central Avenue in Catskill, New York. The Repair Cafe invites residents to bring their broken but beloved items to be fixed for free by a team of talented local volunteers. These skilled fixers specialize in a wide range of repairs, including mechanical and electrical repairs, electronics, computers, sewing and mending, jewelry, woodwork, and more. The goal, to promote a culture of sustainability, reuse, and community engagement one fix at a time. And joining us this morning from the Catskill Repair Cafe are Jackie Arsenuk, the event coordinator, Tim Firstnow, a volunteer fixer, artist, and founder of the Toolshed Library in Hudson, and Ben, coordinator of Climate Smart Catskill and the cafe's resident bike repair expert. I think we've got you all there. Hello.
Oh, hi, thank you.
Hello.
Hi, guys. Jackie, thanks for being here. Can you give us the big picture? What exactly is the Repair Cafe, if I didn't say it properly there in the intro, and how did this one come to life in Catskill?
Sure. Yeah, you were pretty thorough with your explanation, but just to reiterate, yeah, we are events. We provide fixes to local community for free, and our cafes are held in over 70 locations throughout the Hudson Valley, Catskill, Capital Region, and North Country. I had helped to create the cafe in Saugerties, and then I realized that there wasn't a cafe happening in Greene County, so I figured let me, try to get that underway. So Catskill Cafe is the first in Greene County. And, approximately 75% of our items are fixed, and about 6,500 items were fixed last year, combined between all the cafes in the area. And, like you said, our goal is to transform the mindsets just around our throwaway culture to kind of preserve and pass on those skills to people that come in, as well as future generations, and to foster community sustainability and resilience.
Tim, you've got a really cool background, artist, teacher. You also fix things. What connects all those worlds for you?
Like Jackie said, a repair cafe is a place where you can kind of express creativity and practice it through the fixes. A lot of items that come in just need a sort of a second pair of eyes, you might say, and kind of a careful attention and noticing what's wrong with it. Whereas the fix might not be like something that you need a lot of technical expertise with. So I'm kind of a jack of all, not a specialist, but I have been able to fix some things like a 3D printer, a child's talking doll and things just by sort of taking it apart with the owner and oftentimes working with them to sort of assess what's wrong and fix it. And yeah, the sort of community aspect of it is an important piece of it as someone who does community projects and also stewardship. I think of it as kind of like repairing the community a little bit too, by meeting your neighbors and kind of strengthening those social bonds.
Tim, has there been a particular repair moment that really stuck with you, or something that was creatively challenging, or just something that felt good to fix?
The one I mentioned, the kid's doll. It was a 10-year-old girl whose doll had stopped talking, and we kind of did open-heart surgery on it together. And the moment when the doll suddenly started talking again, it was just this, warm, fuzzy kind of moment. And the great thing about it was, as I was fixing it, there were she was sort of working with me, and she was a really clever little girl. And there was a point where she actually corrected me and said, "Oh, I think you're putting that back in backwards." And she was right. And so, really collaborative effort. At the last Catskill event, Ben, who's on the call, helped me with some lubricant on this ancient, dusty belt sander. And, people just come together and sort of collaborate in this spirit at the events. And, I couldn't have done that without Ben. Those two stand out for me.
Hey, Ben, I mentioned you're a coordinator for Climate Smart Catskill, and Jackie has mentioned the sustainability thread that runs through this whole event. Can you talk about how repairing and reusing ties into, bigger climate goals that we all have?
Sure, absolutely. So, at Climate Smart Catskill, our focus is on addressing local climate issues for sustainability and adaptation. And so this is, falls right in there. Like Jackie had said, reusing things rather than throwing them in the landfill. And it also is a great community outreach opportunity for us. A lot of what Climate Smart Catskill does is behind the scenes and in grant making. So this is a really nice opportunity for us to, again, get out in the community. And this upcoming Repair Cafe is right before Earth Day. So it's going to be a bit of a hub for general sustainability activities as well.
Ben, you are the bike mechanic, as I mentioned, providing some bike tune-ups at the event. Have you seen these events inspire more people to think about biking even, or just maintaining their gear more regularly?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Anytime, somebody brings sorry for the background noise. I'm actually at work right now, and that's our air compressor. Anytime anybody, gets a bike out of their basement and is able to ride it again, with the nice weather that we're all seeing today, it's a real inspiration for people to get out, and it provides alternative option for something other than getting around town by your car.
Jackie, as the event coordinator, where do you find amazing volunteer fixers like Ben and Tim?
Really through word of mouth, I would say, connecting with, one entity in the community just opens you up to a variety of other contacts. We also have a coordinator who coordinates all of the cafes in the Hudson Valley, and she keeps, Excel sheet of all other fixers in other counties. And that's one of the great things about having so many repair cafes is that if you bring your item to our cafe and say, we don't have the part on hand and you can't get it readily and you have to order it online, that there's another cafe within probably about a half an hour that you can go to, the next weekend. And there's, we'll give you the website later where people can go on the calendar and see what cafes are happening. The other thing I wanted to say, too, that's great is that people tend to have, a lot of cell phones or items that they have that are broken but they don't really need but they don't want to throw away. That I think it's a great idea to come to the repair cafe, get it fixed, and maybe donate it or bring it to a local shelter. We do hope in the future to have a program where we can collect those items once they're fixed and then, donate them. But right now, it's definitely a place where you can bring your item home or you can donate it once it's fixed.
Do you have a surprising or unusual story of things that people bring in?
I don't know. I'm going to ask Tim on that because we've only had one cafe. So Tim, do you have anything that stands out?
Unusual.
Well, maybe something you weren't expecting because, the list of things that people typically bring in, I guess, are, as you mentioned, electronics, computers, some sewing, mending. We talked about bikes, but, maybe something that you didn't think someone would think that they could get repaired at a cafe.
Teenager brought in a 3D printer once, which tends to be the thing that, you feel like they're brand new and they don't need fixing yet, or they're a tool that a fixer has as part of their sort of toolkit to help fixing other things. So it felt a little strange, but we were able to take apart and actually fix it. And I know nothing about 3D printing, but like I said, just looking closely at something kind of and, finding what screws are loose. And that was nice.
Jackie, let's remind folks about the event coming up this Saturday, where they can get more information, how they can connect.
Sure. So again, it's April 19th, this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Catskill Firehouse at 1 Central Avenue. They can email me at rccatskill@gmail.com. They can go to repaircafehv.org/Catskill. We're also on Facebook and Instagram as the Catskill Repair Cafe.
And you mentioned there's repair cafes almost every weekend. In fact, the following weekend, Saturday, April 26th, there's a repair cafe in Livingston Manor, New York, here in Sullivan County. So, they're all over. And again, fix it, don't toss it. That's Jackie Arseneck, the event coordinator for the Catskill Repair Cafe. Tim Firstnow, volunteer fixer, artist, and founder of the Toolshed Library in Hudson. And Ben, coordinator of Climate Smart Catskill and the cafe's resident bike repair expert. Thank you guys for being here, and have a great cafe.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for being here. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, Ira Flatow here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, a cold front moving in, partly cloudy skies this morning, giving way to more clouds and rain in the afternoon. Temperatures peaking at 60 and then dropping to near 50 and some wind gusts up to 20 miles an hour. Tonight, a few flurries or snow showers possible, low 32. And tomorrow's high, only 41 with gusts of wind up to 40 miles an hour. It's 11 o'clock.